prospects of one of President Trump's picks to the Federal Reserve Board is running into more resistance. A fourth Republican U.S. senator is now saying he would vote against businessman and former presidential candidate Herman Cain should he be formally nominated. That now means Cain would need the support of at least one Democrat to be confirmed, which appears unlikely. Critics say Cain would be too political and are concerned about sexual misconduct allegations that came up during his 2012 presidential campaign. Still, White House economic adviser Larry Kudlow said this morning that the administration has Cain's back, at least, quote, at the moment.
As the president said yesterday, he continues to support him. And we will see how that turns out. I don't want to prejudge it one way or the other. We will be in, we have already, in fact, started consultations with the Senate Banking Committee. Senator Crapo, who's a good man, a friend of mine, they will go through their own process. I don't want to prejudge it.
Meanwhile, there are also concerns over Trump's other Fed pick, Stephen Moore. So what effect could Cain and Moore have on economic policy? And just what is the Fed and what does it do? Heather Long is the economics correspondent with The Washington Post. Heather, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good to be here.
Let's start with the most recent news. Why does President Trump want Herman Cain on the Fed board?
Well, he wants both of these picks because he's really unhappy with what the Federal Reserve is doing. Particularly last year, they raised interest rates four times. President Trump argues that those rate hikes hurt the economy and really killed the stock market at the end of last year. And he's trying to send a message. And that message is new direction. And so he's going to bring two people who are his allies, who think like him and want lower interest rates.
So many of those opposed to Herman Cain say he's too political. What are they getting at there with that critique?
Herman Cain has three strikes against him, and that's why you see this really almost unusual revolt by Senate Republicans to say, absolutely not, are we going to approve Herman Cain for the Fed board? You know, number one is what you mentioned, that he's too political. He's raised a ton of money for President Trump. Just last month, he raised money and put TV ads in Ohio on behalf of the president. So he's come out and defended the president when the president has been in, people have said that the president's made too many racial comments. Herman Cain is an African-American businessman, has said, you know, no, the president isn't racist. This notion that he's not qualified to be on the Federal Reserve Board. Yes, he's a businessman, and there's been a lot of great business people who have served on the Fed board and served very well. But Herman Cain has said a number of things about the economy and about banking policy and what's called monetary policy that just are totally off the wall. Like, they're not correct at all. He was in an interview just a couple of days ago, and like, he didn't know the difference between various types of government job and unemployment data. He was like mixing things up. Mm-hmm. And like, if you don't even know the basics about economic data, then it's a little bit hard to think that this person should be one of seven key members of the Federal Reserve who are going to determine economic policy when he doesn't even know the basics. And then I think the third strike against him is something we had on the front page today. There are four women who have accused Herman Cain of sexually harassing them. Most of these occurrences were in the late 1990s when Herman Cain was head of the National Restaurant Association here in D.C., a lobbying group. And that's a real problem. Obviously, we just had that very contentious hearing last summer for the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. I think both Republicans and Democrats, they really don't want to open that Pandora's box again, particularly in an instance where there's four people who are accusing Herman Cain.
I want to go back to the point of whether he is qualified or understands economic and monetary policy to be in this decision-making position, because he is a big proponent of the gold standard. It was part of his presidential campaign, and he still believes in that. Can you briefly explain to us what that means and why he's a proponent of it?
Sure. It literally means he thinks that every dollar that you have in your pocket should be transferred, or should you should be able to hand that in and get a small amount of gold back for it. So that used to be how the U.S. currency and all currencies around the world for much of the 1800s and early 1900s were done that way. And that was a way to standardize the value of every currency around the world. If I knew that the U.S. dollar was worth, you know, an ounce of gold, and I knew the Swiss franc was worth, 1.5 ounces of gold. You know, you could. That's how you could set an exchange rate. That's how you could sort of have this global, underlying basis of gold that would underlie every transaction we had around the world. Over time, that sounded like a really good idea. But we've had a number of big crises, big depressions in this country and other countries around the world. And so when we hit that early 1930s and the United States went into a massive, the Great Depression, people were saying, things are really bad right now. And having our currency tied to gold means that basically that you can't print more money. It makes it very difficult to go out and pump more money into the economy, either through the government spending more on building bridges or public works projects, because where's that gold going to come from? It's not like we're just going to go, discover gold on Mars. And so, that's why over time the United States began to abandon the gold standard in the Great Depression, and we fully got off of it in 1971 under President Nixon. We fully abandoned it, and the rest of the world has too. Most people say, hey, the 60s, 70s, 80s were pretty prosperous times. People are very happy that we're not on the gold standard anymore.
We're talking with Heather Long. She's economics correspondent with The Washington Post. We're talking about two potential nominees to the Federal Reserve Board that President Trump is floating as possibilities. We're also getting a little more of an understanding of what the Fed does and how it impacts us in our daily lives. Let's turn to the other possible nominee, Stephen Moore. What is his background?
Yeah, Stephen Moore is he's very much more of a live possibility to be on the Fed board. He's really well known in conservative circles. He has a master's in economics from George Mason University, which has produced a lot of libertarian economists over the years. But Steve has spent most of his career at conservative think tanks like the Heritage Foundation. He was their chief economic analyst there at the Heritage Foundation for many years. He was an editorial writer for the Wall Street Journal covering economic issues. He has basically been the mouthpiece for supply side economics for the past 30 years. He and Larry Kudlow, who's now the president's National Economic Council director, they believe strongly in tax cuts, that tax cuts stimulate the economy, that tax cuts are sort of the cure-all to most of the economic problems that we have in this country. And Steve Moore's been a very good defender of that. Where people have problems with him is they say, look, he's an expert on, or seen as an expert on taxes and debt and fiscal policy. He is not seen as an expert for the past 30 years on monetary policy. And in fact, he himself, when he's been asked about interest rates or bank policies over the years, has made comments like, well, I'm not an expert in monetary policy. So it's been a little bit of a head scratcher why he's suddenly being put forward for this role at the Federal Reserve.
And what is his relationship with President Trump or with businessman Donald Trump before he was president?
That's a great question. So Steve Moore and Larry Kudlow and Art Laffer. So these three, Art Laffer is another economist. They are this sort of triumvirate, this trio that champion supply side economics. And they wrote Donald Trump's tax plan on the campaign trail, which ultimately became the basis of the tax cuts that were enacted at the end of President Trump's first year in office. Steve Moore has remained in close contact with the president. The president calls him occasionally to get his sound off economic ideas. And it just so happened that Stephen Moore had, in March, when the president was really upset with the Fed, happened to have written an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that said just what President Trump had been saying, that, be careful, don't let the Fed hurt growth. And President Trump saw that op-ed, and he called over Larry Kudlow, the economic advisor, and he said, hey, Larry, why isn't Steve the chair of the Federal Reserve? And Larry said, well, Steve, he can't be the chair. We already have a chairman. We have this Jerome Powell that you appointed, Mr. President, as the chair, but we could name Stephen Moore to be one of seven Fed governors. And that's exactly what happened about a day or two after that conversation.
So can you tell us in very basic layperson's terms, what is the Fed and what does it do?
Sure. In a basic level, the Federal Reserve is our central bank. And what that means is they have two primary responsibilities. Number one is they watch over the banks. So they make sure that the banks don't do anything truly, truly scandalous, horrible, wrong, you know, that sort of thing. And the other thing that they do is they help steer the economy, if you will. They you know, help have their hands on the steering wheel. And the main way they do that is by lowering or raising interest rates. So when they raise interest rates, they're basically tapping the brakes on the economy. They're saying, wait a minute, things are getting a little overheated here. You know, we're a little bit worried that various problems will take off, like bubbles could form in the stock market, or prices could start spiking. You know, if suddenly you go to the grocery store and your favorite cereal or whatever is double the price. You know, we don't want runaway inflation, and we don't want bubbles. So that's why they sometimes raise interest rates, to just tap the brakes. Then in times of duress, like what we saw, we all remember 2008, 2009, horrible financial crisis, the central bank does the opposite. They cut rates, and that's meant to try to spur people to invest more, to spend more, to go and borrow money, because it's really, really cheap to borrow money.
And there are also 12 regional Fed banks throughout the country. What role do they play?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, much like most of the U.S. government, when they designed the central bank, the Federal Reserve was created in 1913. So, you know, we're just over a century of the central bank that we have today. Much like the rest of the government, they didn't want all the power to be in Washington. And so they created this really interesting system where you have these seven governors, of which Stephen Moore and Herman Cain could potentially be one, who sit in Washington, and they help craft policy and decide if interest rates should go up or down. But then you have 12 what are called regional Fed banks across the country. I'm from Pennsylvania. There's one in Philadelphia. There's one in New York City. You know, there's one in St. Louis. In Chicago, I believe, is probably the closest one to you all. There's one in Minneapolis, one in San Francisco, one in Dallas, one in Atlanta. You get the idea. And the point was, just like our Senate or our Congress, you have all of these people who are spanned out across the country, and that makes it easier to keep an eye on banks all across the country, and it makes it easier to take the pulse of the economy, because, you know, things might look good in San Francisco where the tech boom is, but they might not look so good in the industrial Midwest or in the farm belt. And so by having these 12 banks, it makes it easier for the Federal Reserve to really understand the economy and to make decisions that benefit the entire country and not just, you know, DC and Wall Street types.
We're talking with Heather Long about the Fed, who runs it, what it does, and how it affects us. She's the economics correspondent with The Washington Post. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of President Trump's picks to the Fed, Stephen Moore and Herman Cain? What questions do you have about the Federal Reserve and what it does? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our conversation with Heather Long. She's the economics correspondent for The Washington Post, and we're talking about the controversy surrounding President Trump's picks to the Fed, as well as getting an understanding of what the Fed is, how it works, who runs it, and how its policies affect us. And I wanted to talk about that interest rate that you mentioned earlier, Heather. Interest rates are at 2.5%. Federal Reserve officials met yesterday and left open the possibility of raising rates before year's end. And if the economy improves, that's not what President Trump wants them to do. In fact, he wants the interest rates lowered. How exactly do interest rates affect us?
That's a great question. So the interest rates that the Federal Reserve sets essentially translate out to you and me and all your listeners. It impacts what rates are charged for credit cards, what rates are charged for mortgages, and what rates you might get, like if you want to go to the bank and borrow money to start a business of or to plant crops this year, you have to go and talk to the bank to borrow money. Those interest rates that you're going to get, or loan rates, are directly related to what the Federal Reserve is doing when they meet 8 times a year and make a decision to raise, to lower, or to keep the same. So again, as the Fed raises those interest rates, you see it gets more expensive to borrow money. Those mortgage rates start going up, those credit card rates start going up, it's more expensive to borrow a loan. On the upside, if you save a lot of money, as the Fed raises rates, you get more interest on your savings account, and as they lower it, you get less interest.
Are there other direct effects that we, as just average citizens, feel that are the result of decisions by the Federal Reserve?
Well, generally speaking, it's about it's also about confidence in the economy and what happens with the stock market. So when the Fed is cutting rates, that's usually a sign that the economy is not doing well, that it's on the rocks, that it needs some emergency stimulus. It's sort of like going to the triage department at the hospital. And you start to see a little bit of panic. You start to see maybe markets will start to fall in scenarios like that. Certainly we saw that in 2008-2009. The same is true for a while when the Fed was raising rates in 2017 and in early 2018. Raising rates was actually applauded by the stock market. You saw the stocks rise because people were saying, hey, the Fed must think that the economy is so strong that, it's almost overheating, and that's why they're raising rates. This is like a vote of confidence in the economy. But we got to a point at the end of last year, where the Fed raised rates for the fourth time last year to that 2.5 you mentioned, and that's when you started to see business leaders, Wall Street investors, and even some folks on Main Street say, This is a little bit too fast of rate hikes for us, and we actually saw the market fall, and we saw a big loss of confidence in a lot of parts of the economy at the end of last year, heading into this year. And I think the Fed looked around and said, there's no exact playbook for what they should do. It's really a bit of a feel, how they feel the economy is doing, and they sort of corrected course and said, okay, we're going to pause. We're not going to raise or lower interest rates at all this year. We're just going to go on timeout.
Let's go to the phones, and Jonathan in Columbus is up. Hi, Jonathan. Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question. Does the Federal Reserve actually have money, like a real bank?
That's a great question. Can you set us straight on that?
Yeah, that is a great question. Yes and no. So there's a misnomer that the Fed can just print its own money. The Treasury prints money, well, actually the Mint, but it's instructed by the U.S. Treasury. So the Fed isn't sitting around in the basement running the printer. That said, the Federal Reserve does have, like any bank does, they have assets. And in this case, at the moment, they have around $4 trillion worth of assets. They hold some of that in cash. They hold some of that in bonds, U.S. Treasury bonds. And the reason that they have that money is when we see something like 2008-2009, that crunch, that financial crisis, the Fed acts as the final backstop. Like if you and I ran to the bank and we said, we demand our money back right now, we're so scared, we want our cash right now today. The bank is they're not going to have enough money to pay everybody all at the same time. But the Fed can basically make loans to banks to help them pay when they're a little short in terms of paying, the customers or whomever they need to pay. So that's a big part of the reason that they hold money at the Federal Reserve. It's not that they're, hoarding cash, or they're doing it as like a final backstop, a final pocket, a final bowl of money, if you will, for that rainy day when some bank, is about to go under or is in a very bad situation, and the Fed can step in and prevent a bigger calamity.
We don't have a lot of time left, Heather, but I wanted to ask, from what I've read, it seems that President Trump has been more willing to express publicly his thoughts and his wishes and his frustrations with the Fed than other presidents have of both parties. Is that accurate?
That's pretty accurate. We certainly haven't seen this level of hatred or directed at the Federal Reserve really since Richard Nixon. Some people would argue since Ronald Reagan, but President Reagan tended to do his complaints behind closed doors to the Fed as opposed to out in the open. So this is very unusual to see. Normally, the Fed is supposed to be independent. It's supposed to be making long, much like the Supreme Court, it's supposed to be making long-term decisions in the best interest of the economy, not short-term decisions that could help somebody's 2020 reelection or not.
And a caller, actually, it seems it goes with this, a caller asked if having the Federal Reserve as a private entity and not actually part of the government would be an option.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. That's an interesting idea. It may be something to think about. I think when it was initially conceived in 1913, it was partially helped crafted by several prominent Wall Street bankers of the day. I think the reason they wanted it to be a government entity is because they were hoping to have that check and balance of the president nominates people to be on the Fed board.
And we'll have to leave it there. I'm so sorry, Heather. Thank you for joining us. Heather Long is the economics correspondent for The Washington Post. She joined us to talk about President Trump's picks for the Federal Reserve Board. And we also talked about what the Fed is, what it does, who runs it, and how its policies affect us. Thanks again to Heather Long for joining us.